Hi, I'm Megan Riley, and I am not your normal relationship and sex coach. Remember how he used to look at you? Let's get that back. This isn't going to be about texting the right thing or manipulating him. It's about changing you and you becoming more you. And I am going to be here to help every step of the way. This is the Ignite the Fire podcast. Hi, ladies. Welcome back. Welcome to Ignite the Fire. Today, Dr. Emily Nagoski. I now have a researcher crush. A Dr. Emily Nagoski, writer, educator, researcher, activist, nerd. She is a sex educator and has written two books, Come As You Are, which we are talking about today, and Burnout. So today in Come As You Are, we're talking about drive, we're talking about desire, we're talking about all things sexuality. We even go a little bit into shades of gray and maybe a little bit of politics. But what's interesting and really exciting is there are things that you can do today. And the biggest thing to walk away from is, first of all, it doesn't matter where you are in the spectrum. It doesn't matter if you have a very light accelerator or a very heavy accelerator, or a very light brake, or a very heavy brake. None of this matters, and you are perfect just the way you are. So let's take all the shame out of thinking that we should be some other way sexually than the way that we are, that we are perfect just now. And one myth that we are going to take out of conversation, we are going to dispel and take out of conversation, and hopefully I can get your buy-in on this. Thank you so much, and please enjoy Dr. Nagoski. Dr. Nagoski, thank you so much.
Totally my pleasure.
So I found you, Charlie Glickman was on a couple of episodes here about jobs and prostate massage, and mm-hmm. did Come As You Are. I got to tell you, I got the book, and I love the cover. Love the cover. I have a huge 3-foot vulva on my wall.
And
it's like under the spotlight, and it, you know, is my, that's my living room. So to just this, but this really like a game changer. So many women on both sides of the spectrum, there's so much shame about low desire, and there's so much shame about high desire.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me how you came to this, and then you can explain it so much better than I.
Okay, sort of like the origin story of Come As You Are is I've been a sex educator since my first year as an undergraduate. I went to University of Delaware, born and raised in Delaware, and I was a big nerd, so I knew I'd be going to grad school for something. I had no idea for what, but I was like, okay, so I need, you know, volunteer work on my resume to make me look like a good candidate for grad school. And a guy on my floor said, hey, come be a peer health educator with me. And I was like, I like health. Why not? So I did. I applied. I got accepted. I started getting trained to go into residence halls to talk about condoms, contraception, and consent. And a thing I noticed early on was that I didn't have the same sort of like response that a lot of people did when talking about genitals and periods and sex and all that kind of stuff. And I felt like that might be an indication that this was a good space for me. But while I was doing that volunteer work, my actual degree I was earning was in, it was in psychology with minors in cognitive science and philosophy. I had this plan to be a clinical neuropsychologist working with people with traumatic brain injury and stroke. Like, I love the brain stuff. You can tell from the book that I love the brain stuff. But the work I was doing as a sex educator and then as a sexual assault prevention educator and ultimately as a sexual assault crisis responder made me like who I am as a person in a way that the academic stuff just never could. So that is the path I chose. I went to Indiana University for a master's degree in counseling psychology, started out getting trained to be a sex therapist, quickly realized that I am not temperamentally suited to being a therapist, but I am a woman who likes to be in charge of things, which means PhD. So I stayed at IU. I got a PhD in health behavior with a concentration in human sexuality and eventually ended up as the director of wellness education at Smith College. I had been teaching human sexuality sort of all along in the classroom and out. And at Smith, I taught a class called Women's Sexuality. And the first semester I taught there, man, we kicked each other's asses, those students and I. They asked the hardest questions and I pushed them really hard. I gave them really big science to digest. And at the end of this long, hard semester, my last question on the final exam was, just tell me, out of all this science, tell me one important thing you learned. What actually mattered to you? And I had 187 students in this class.
Oh my gosh.
Out of 187, more than half of them answered something like, I learned I'm normal. I'm normal. Just because I'm different from other women doesn't mean there's anything wrong with me. Just because my partner says something is true about my body doesn't mean it is. I can trust my body. I'm normal. I don't know how much time you've spent grading final exams in your life, but it is not usually like this. I was sitting in my office grading with tears in my eyes. Really like something intense and special had happened and that I had worked for it and like it worked, like something important, crucial had happened for these students. And that was the day I decided to write Come As You Are so that whatever it was that happened in that classroom, I could create for people who were not necessarily students at this school. A mere 4.5 years later, there it was.
Wow.
It got published. And ever since then, I've been traveling around talking to any audience that will listen about the science of women's sexual well-being.
Well, I have never heard it like Accelerator and Break. There's so much shame anyway around sexuality. There's so much shame about what we know and what we don't know. And we assume that we should wake up being a porn star and just that should be our sexuality. But an Accelerator and a Break.
Right. So this is chapter 2. And I remember the day I learned it. And I also like just felt my brain explode. Like, of course, this is how it works. Eric Jansen and John Bancroft at the Kinsey Institute developed this model based on the wacky idea that the way sexuality works in our brains and central nervous system is the same as the way everything else works in our brains and sexual nervous system, which is a dual control mechanism of an accelerator and brake. So what they hypothesized and what has turned out to be true over the last 15 years of research is that there's a sexual accelerator that notices all the sex-related information in the environment. Everything that you see and hear, smell, touch, taste, imagine, that your brain codes as related to sex. If that gets struck, then it sends the turn-on signal that most of us are familiar with. And it works all the time at a low level, including right now. The fact that we're like talking about sex is a little bit sex related. So there's just a little bit of turn on signal. And at the same time, in parallel, you've got this break, noticing all the good reasons not to be turned on. Everything that you see, hear, smell, touch, taste, or, and this is really crucial, imagine that your brain codes as a potential threat. And it sends the turn off signal. So the arousal process is not just turning on the ons, it's also about turning off the offs. And it turns out when people are struggling, sometimes it's because there's not enough stimulation to the accelerator, but more often it's because there's too much stimulation to the brake. And that's partly because the brake can respond to such a wide range of factors. So I often recommend that people, like a really just a baseline thing to do is make a list of things you know for sure, activate your accelerator and things you know for sure, keep the brakes on. Mm-hmm. And then sort of get a sense of which of those things you have control over. Because some things like being afraid of being interrupted, that's something you can do something about. Being distracted by the grit on the sheets, you can do something about that. Stress is a little more complicated. Mm-hmm. Body image is a little more complicated, takes some more time to undo that as a brakes hitter. Trauma history takes more time, a little more effort to undo that impact on your brakes. But it absolutely can happen. I hear stories pretty much every day from trauma survivors who've done a lot of work and have found their way back to sexual pleasure and joy. So that's the dual control model.
Wow. Now, I'm curious, what have you discovered about the women who have very sensitive accelerators and the women who have very sensitive? Is there anything that correlates?
So most of us are just sort of like average. We're heaped up in the middle in the sensitivity of our accelerators and brakes. But a small proportion of women have a very sensitive accelerator. A small proportion of women have a very sensitive brake. And having a very sensitive accelerator doesn't predict what strength your brake is going to be. So you can have any combination of like strength or non-responsiveness. But if you have a really sensitive accelerator, I mean, it's like a car. If your car has a really sensitive accelerator, how does that car go? Zroom, right? which can sound fun on the surface, and it can be. It's nice and easy to become sexually aroused, but these folks are actually more likely to experience sexual risk-taking and sexual compulsivity because their brain can so easily go to sexual response. It makes it really easy shortcut or a way to get around other negative feelings. If you're feeling stressed, depressed, anxious, lonely, exhausted, overwhelmed, repressed rage, we've all got it. You can avoid having to deal with those feelings because your brain will just be like, just masturbate and have an orgasm, and then you won't have to think about all this other stuff. So if a person has this sensitivity and also does not have adequate coping skills, they can find themselves in a place of using sex as a way to cope with feelings that results in unwanted consequences, like increased risk of the various unwanted consequences of sexuality. If you have a really sensitive break, it's sort of the opposite. The women with sensitive breaks are the most likely to seek treatment in sex therapy. They're the most likely to report difficulty with desire, orgasm, arousal. People are wondering, is that me? How strongly do you identify with the statement, things have to be just right in order for me to be sexually aroused? If the least thing, a stray fingernail, a stray sound, a stray thought can just interrupt everything and shut it down, then it might be that you have a really sensitive break. And as far as we know right now, that's not something you can change, but it is a thing you can learn how to manage. You can teach your brain how not to respond to certain things because they're not actually threats. The short answer to how to do that is there's this wonderful book called Better Sex Through Mindfulness by Lori Brotto, L-O-R-I-B-R-O-T-T-O. She has developed a mindfulness-based intervention working with women who have survived gynecological cancers, who've survived sexual violence. And this mindfulness-based intervention that combines psychoeducation and mindfulness around sexuality significantly improves sexual satisfaction, relationship satisfaction, access to pleasure, even in women who've struggled with these really serious issues.
Wow.
Yeah, I love that book.
I love what you're saying, because it comes across like a diagnosis. So women who identify with high drive, women who identify with low drive, there is so much more going on. And we get all into the brain stuff here that it doesn't have to be a diagnosis.
Right. You know, it's just an individual differences in brain. It's as much a diagnosis as like this person has a high intensity personality. It's just a personality trait, really.
And that either side really does then cut the other side. So for those of us who do identify with high accelerator, I wish wouldn't a low accelerator or a higher break be better and not be putting gas into our tank and getting aroused, right? And then on the other side, the women that I talk to so wish that they could be high accelerator, that there is a way to really blend those.
Oh, yeah, because what matters far more than the brain mechanism itself is the environment you have around you that is stimulating the accelerator or not and stimulating the brake or not. And though we don't have much control over the brain itself, we do tend to have some control over the aspects of our environment, the context that are influencing how our brains are responding.
So let's go to somewhere in between of low accelerator, high break, with kids and dishes and dog, businesses and cold feet, and
cold feet, right.
Literally, what can these women do?
What I recommend, so I'm imagining like partnered cisgender woman with all the sort of like regular life stuff, a job and kids and all the things. What I like to recommend is, so this is, it's a little bit of an effortful activity, but it's totally worth it. Sit down and think through one by one, three really great sexual experiences that you've had. And you think about it in terms of this handful of evidence-based environmental or contextual factors that influence the quality of a sexual interaction. So there's your own personal well-being, both mental and physical health. There are partner characteristics. There are relationship characteristics. And the most important relationship characteristic, of course, is trust. Sue Johnson, the therapist and researcher who developed emotionally focused therapy, boils trust down to this question, are you there for me? And partners, man, sex is so vulnerable that we have to really know that our partner is going to be there for us. Because you might be like taking off some of your clothes and letting them see maybe parts of your body almost nobody ever gets to see. And if their reaction is anything short of, yay, then that's going to hit the brakes, right? Because they weren't 100% there for you in that really vulnerable moment. So we have personal well-being, partner characteristics, relationship characteristics, setting, which is, are you at home and quiet in a familiar bed? Are you on vacation? Are the kids home? Are you sexting? Is it video and distance? Or is your partner right there in the room? Is it a public setting or a private setting? Are you in a closet at a party at a stranger's house, right? Like different settings are going to work for different people. So think about what that setting was. There are my favorite one is ludic factors. Ludic has the same root as the word ludicrous. So it just means play. So like what playful things were you doing together that felt really awesome? And then my favorite category, other life circumstances. Like, were you worried about money? Did you not have like a safe place to live or like a safe room you could go to have sex? Were you like sweating the patriarchy these days? These like sex happens in the context of your overall life. And in fact, the best predictor of a woman's sexual well-being is her overall well-being. Mm-hmm. So you think through three different great experiences, and what you're going to notice is a pattern starts to emerge of which of these factors are most important in creating a context that lets your body activate the accelerator and lets the brakes just float right away. And sometimes they are, like you mentioned, cold feet. This is one of my favorite facts ever, is the researcher who was doing functional MRI study of orgasm in the brain. It's really difficult to have an orgasm in an fMRI machine. Only half of the research participants who even among those who are like, sure, I'll try to do that, masturbate to orgasm in an fMRI, only half of people are able to do it. But this Dutch researcher found he could double people's likelihood of having an orgasm by letting them wear socks in the fMRI machine. So there you are in this room with this big thing going ding, 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 ding. It's really noisy. It's a very unsexy context. But it turns out people's feet were cold and it was distracting them. So all it took was giving them socks. They had one less thing hitting the brakes and they were freed up to have an orgasm. Sometimes it's that simple. And sometimes the context is something like, there were no more dishes in the sink. And I felt like I could let go of all the householding stuff. Like the kids were out of the house. Sometimes it's, I met someone who had really great vacation sex at one specific vacation home they visited sometimes. They tried going to the same city but a different house and the magic did not happen there. And they realized it's because this house was very old and the bed was built into the wall. So it was silent. And their kids could not hear any squeaking at all. Oh. And she could just totally relax and not worry about that squeaking sound. So when they went to build a house, they built the bed into the wall.
Wow. Yes.
So, but then after you do the three like awesome experiences and you're getting a sense of what really works for you, do the same thing for three sexual experiences that are just okay. Not a terrible one. We know what makes the terrible sexual experiences terrible. So just do sort of ones that were just like, we had sex. Okay. And then and keep looking at these same contextual factors. What was my personal physical and mental well-being, partner characteristics, relationship characteristics, setting, ludic factors, play, and other life circumstances. And get a sense of the pattern. I've had people who really have like done a lot of work around their sexuality and felt like they had a bunch of insight already go through this process and learn astonishing things. One friend of mine did it and she was in a long distance relationship. And she realized that on the rare occasions when she and her partner could be physically together, she felt all this pressure to perform and have the sex because like, now's your chance. Now or never, better do it. And that pressure, that expectation, that feeling almost of obligation, ironically really hit the brakes for her. So when she could eliminate the expectation and her partner could be ready for the fact that sex might not happen, it eased up the brakes and made sex much easier for her. It made her much ready to access desire and pleasure.
Oh, I love this. You do the same thing for negative sexual experiences too?
I stick with not so great ones because I feel like people usually are very clear on what makes a terrible sexual experience terrible.
Right.
There's something terrible about the relationship. There's something terrible about your own physical health. You're experiencing pain. Of course, that's a terrible experience.
Mm-hmm. And what about vaginismus?
Yeah.
Where that's not necessarily a terrible sexual experience, but Have you studied this? And is it about safety?
So vaginismus is actually, sometimes it's about safety, but very often the couples who come in to seek treatment for vaginismus, so just quick definition, it is chronic inhibitory tone of the pubococcygeal muscle at the mouth of the vagina so that like nothing can get in there. This is a person who probably can't put a tampon in, who's never had any kind of intercourse, who has struggled to have any kind of gynecological exam because the speculum won't go in. That's often how they get the diagnosis in the first place, is because a gynecological exam doesn't happen or it's extraordinarily painful. And we don't know. There's not a very significant relationship between, say, trauma history and vaginismus. There does seem to be a relationship with sexual shame and vaginismus. Like if you grew up in a culture that just taught you that your body doesn't quite belong to you and that's a dangerous place, there's this sort of like tension that builds up. It's a physical tension in that muscle that locks it up tight. So treatment can involve like getting insight into why it is your muscle is in the state it's in. But mostly all it is a matter of systematic desensitization, of increasing your awareness of that muscle, learning how to feel what it feels like to tense that muscle and relax that muscle, and tense that muscle and relax that muscle. And you may gradually, over a period of several weeks, introduce either a finger or dilators of increasing diameter, going really gently and really slowly, training your body to practice the skill, basically, of tightening and relaxing this muscle. Most of us have practiced tightening this muscle, like if we've practiced Kegel exercises or something like this, and less of us pay attention to the experience of learning to soften and relax that muscle too. So it's highly treatable. Outcomes are very positive for vaginismus overall. And the thing that can get in the way mostly is when people are too worried about it. When I was getting my training in sex therapy, there was a couple who came in for therapy around vaginismus. They were a young married couple. They were virgins when they got married. It was important to them for their faith that they were. Then they tried to have sex and it was not happening. And it actually been a couple of years. Now they were ready to have kids. And that was why they came in. They went through a combination of this like dilator training where she gradually practiced relaxing that muscle and tensing it, having control over it. And they did standard sensate focus therapy where they got to touch each other's bodies and practice initiation and consent and alternating who started and touching each other in different places. And it was really beautiful and they enjoyed the process and was ultimately quite successful because they had a really strong foundation to start with of like sexual communication and they loved and respected each other. You could feel it in the way they saw each other in the room. So vaginismus is pretty treatable when that groundwork is there already. Does that make sense?
Yes. Absolutely. I have spoken to some women who seem to develop something along the lines of vaginismus only in certain relationships.
Yeah.
Or only with one certain person, not other partners, only this partner. Yeah, super curious.
Yes. So there's not a whole lot of research to point to, but it's easy to sort of tell a story of like, basically, because it's a physically tensed muscle, the question is like, under what circumstances does this muscle stay tight? And what does it take for me to relax it? Is my body trying to tell me something about this relationship or these behaviors or what's going on here? That's just the hypothesis. I don't know. I can't point to any research of people who have, I would like sort of vaguely call that a secondary vaginismus. Primary vaginismus would be like primary anorgasmia. Like you've never had any penetration. Nothing has ever gone in there, as opposed to sort of like secondary vaginismus. This is not official technical language. I'm just trying to like sort of classify the distinction. That we, there's research on the first one, and I don't know a lot about research on the second one.
How interesting. Okay, so this is a great segue. Non-concordance, is that right?
Non-concordance.
Non-concordance. Okay, game changer.
Right?
Yes.
It turns out the structure in our brain that governs pleasure, like we call it the pleasure center or the reward center of your brain, if you hear somebody call it that, maybe they're just trying to simplify things, or maybe they don't quite know what they're talking about.
Ooh.
Because it's not just the pleasure center. Pleasure is absolutely one part. It's sort of like calling the vulva the vagina.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's one important part. Not going to deny that. But if we ignore the other parts, we're going to miss out on some really important functions. and be really confused when we're trying to understand how the vulva works. So if we just think of it as the reward center or pleasure center, we're going to be missing out on a bunch of other stuff. There's actually three intertwined but separable systems. The first one is pleasure. It's the little opioid hotspots spread throughout the emotional brain. It responds to basic pleasure. If you put sugar water on the tongue of a baby, it will make these faces, right? This is the opioid hotspots will just light up because sugar is innately rewarding. When a person experiences a pleasurable sensation, same thing happens. That's straight up pleasure. And then there's a whole separate system. This one's actually really big, this sort of like big dopaminergic network that extends all through the emotional brain and into the cognitive parts of our brain. This is the dopamine system, and it's the wanting system or desire system. This is the one that makes us go after things. So if something tastes good, that might make us want more of it. And that's when the dopamine system kicks in and makes us, you know, if your toddler has found out what cookies are and knows where the cookies are, will follow you around going, hey, can I have a cookie? Can I have a cookie? Can I have a cookie? Because they know that it tastes good. And so the wanting comes in. So pleasure and desire clearly linked to each other, but they are not identical. They're separable. And then there's the third system, which is my favorite one. Unfortunately, I have to use a really silly metaphor to explain it, which is Pavlov's dogs. He trained dogs to salivate in response to a bell. It's very simple. Anyone can do it. You just give a dog food. It salivates automatically, and then you ring a bell. Food, salivate, bell. Food, salivate, bell. And eventually you can just go, bell, salivate, bell, salivate. What you've done is you've taught the dog that the bell is a food-related stimulus. Does the drooling mean the dog wants to eat the bell? No. Does it mean that the dog thinks the bell is delicious? No. It just means that this is a cue that predicts food's going to happen. Therefore, salivation, which is the unconditioned response. It's just, that's just what dogs do when food is around. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So non-concordance is when there is a mismatch between what's going on with the liking system, the wanting system, and this learning system. It turns out there is anywhere between a 10 and 50% overlap between these things. So among the folks, often men on average have this higher degree of concordance where their physiological response, their blood flow matches their self-reported desire or arousal or pleasure. It can be up to 50%. 50% is not 100%, right? But statistically, it is super significant. In women on average, the overlap tends to be about 10%, which is not at all statistically significant. And the primary reason it's such a small relationship is that women's genitals respond with blood flow. And I should specify that it turns out this is just heterosexually identified women. Their blood flow responds to kind of sort of anything remotely sex related, not just including like porn that is not to their taste, but like images of bonobo chimpanzees copulating. Their genitals will, they don't respond as much as to the human porn, but significantly above baseline. And again, does the blood flow mean the women want to have sex with the chimpanzees? Does it mean they like that sex? No, it just means their brain's like, I guess that's sort of sex related. So sure, why not? Let's do a thing. What this means is that you can't necessarily predict based on what a person's blood flow is doing, whether they want or like what is going on. Does that make sense so far?
Uh-huh.
And I want to point out that this does happen with every emotional and motivational system. One of my favorite examples of non-concordance in the non-sex research is when they study the chills that people experience listening to music. They take research participants and they literally just put a camera right next to a person's arm and they're going to watch for piloerection, whether or not a person's hair stands on end, which is the physiological cue for chills, right? And then they play songs that have been established to give people the experience of chills, like My Heart Will Go On or Purple Rain, right? Uh-huh. And then they ask people, did you experience the chills? And they look at whether or not their hair stood on end. Turns out there's not a statistically significant relationship between the thing we physiologically just think is a cue and the subjective experience. And if you're Celine Dion, which of those things matters to you? The people walk out the door going, nah, I guess that was okay, but their hair stood on end? Or does it matter more that they walk out going, oh, I got chills, even if their hair stayed totally flat? Right? Like, you definitely, it's the subjective experience that matters to you. Or if I bite into like a moldy, bruised peach and my mouth waters, is anybody going to say to me, well, Emily, you just don't want to admit how much you like that moldy, bruised peach? No, we all understand that sometimes your body does stuff that doesn't match how you subjectively feel. But when it comes to sex, somehow or other, we get stuck in this state of thinking that a person's body is a more honest indicator of what a person wants or likes than the person attached to those genitals, which it is my mission in life to make sure we stop doing this, because it happens in every direction, right? I've had phone calls from friends like, we were in the middle of stuff and I was so excited and ready, and I told my partner, I want you. And he was like, no, you're not wet. You're just being nice.
Mm-hmm.
And like, is there something hormonal wrong? No, that's just arousal non-concordance. Tell him, please, to listen to your words, mm-hmm. which is, you know, that's what we teach our kindergartners to do. It's not difficult. And it goes the other direction too, where it like, I was doing stuff and I was bored, and then my genitals responded and I didn't know what to do or what to say. And even worse, when people's genitals respond during sexual assault, especially when the perpetrator uses that as like, no, don't be shy. You're wet. You're so ready. Mm-hmm. And the person, like, their whole internal experience is like, I don't want this. I want this to stop. No. But they're telling me my body's responding. And all my life I've been taught that if my body is doing a thing, that must mean what I want or like. Especially if a person was gender socialized feminine, we are taught to believe other people's opinions about our bodies more than we believe and trust what our own internal experience is trying to tell us. I have lost count of the number of stories I hear from people who experience unwanted sex or whose partners tried to convince them that they really did want or like something because their genitals were responding. And it doesn't matter what shape your genitals are, whether you've got a penis or a clitoris, vulva or scrotum, sometimes your blood flow doesn't match what you want or like. It's arousal non-concordance. We know what it is. We have a sense of what the causal mechanism is. Can we please stop measuring a person's blood flow to assess whether they want or like something?
Please.
Please, right?
Can we please
tell everyone you know?
Stop invalidating ourselves and our bodies because it is responding in one certain way. It doesn't mean that we're not turned on if it's not wet. It doesn't mean we are turned on if it is wet. It doesn't mean any of those things. And so many women invalidate their experience, mm-hmm. what they're feeling, because it must be true if the body is responding.
Right. Because it's what we've been taught our whole lives. The oldest English language sex manual I can find is called Aristotle's Masterpiece. It's neither by Aristotle, nor is it a masterpiece. And this myth that a person's body indicates pleasure, desire, and therefore consent is in that. And it's from the 1500s. It is old. Like, it is difficult to dig this one out. Like, it is so deeply rooted. And it really is rooted in the patriarchy, because it is so easy for a man to tell the story that, well, her genitals, her body said yes, even if she said no. And we're trained not to believe women, like, oh, you crazy woman, you don't even know what you want. You don't even know what you like. And it the hard part is, we have been gender socialized out of awareness of what's going on with our bodies. We've been taught, there was a woman who read Come As You Are, and she tweeted me this story of watching her adult brother changing his baby daughter's diaper. And when she was clean and ready for her new diaper, the little girl reaches down and touches her own genitals, and dad goes, ah, don't touch that. How would he have responded if his baby had a penis instead? Or if she had touched her feet? Like, we're so excited when our babies find their feet, right? That's thrilling for us. But instead, what she gets taught in that moment is that part of her body does not belong to her. It is not hers to do with as she pleases. It is for someone else to control. And she starts to shut down access to that part of her body. She will not remember that moment in her life, but it will accumulate with countless other similar moments, all teaching her this lesson that that part of her body doesn't belong to her. Mm-hmm. And then someone comes along and says, no, your genitals are responding, therefore you want and like this. Like, what can she do but believe him? We're in this like stuck place. And can I tell the 50 Shades of Grey story? Oh God.
Oh yes.
I will start by saying that I am a reader of romance. I do a lot of work around sexual violence, so I require happily ever afters in my life. Romance novels are a great place to get there. What could be more feminist and sex positive than a genre written primarily by women, primarily for women, primarily about women's sexual and relationship satisfaction? Mm. So I had an open mind when I started 50 Shades of Grey. It turned out to be not for me. That's fine. There are lots of people it was for. It gave a lot of people a lot of pleasure. It opened a conversation about women's sexual satisfaction that would not have happened without its enormous impact.
Right? And sales of Silk Rope skyrocketed.
Yes. I have talked to, because 50 Shades came out right around the like deepest part of the economic crash, I heard from a small local feminist sex toy store that their business was saved by women coming in because they learned from 50 Shades that sex toys are, and they wanted to find out more. They wanted to come in and buy stuff. So like, there's been a lot of positive impact. I am not shit talking 50 Shades of Grey, but there was, I did throw it against the wall this one time because in the first spanking scene, Anastasia, our heroine, consents to the spanking. She doesn't want it. She doesn't like it. I read it really carefully, looking for even one word about sexual pleasure. There is not one. She only talks about squirming to get away and how much it hurts, and even her face hurts from squinching so tight against the pain. And at the end of it, Christian Grey, our hero slash banker, says, "Feel this, Anastasia. See how much your body likes this. You're soaking just for me." So I'm reading that, and I'm like, okay, so what did Christian Grey get wrong there? Does Anastasia's genital response say anything at all about how much her body likes this? No. What it says is that a sex-related stimulus happened, which is, you know, her sex and relationship partner was touching her butt. That is a sex-related stimulus, completely. What would be a reliable way to find out whether she liked it? You know, he could ask her. And even though she will later in an email say that she feels, I think it's debased, abused, and degraded by the spanking, because he said, "You got wet, that means you liked it," she believes him instead. And 50 million people bought that book. I mean, Come As You Are has done really, really well for a 110,000-word book on the science of women's sexual well-being, but not 50 million copies well. And 2 million people have watched my TED Talk about arousal nonconcordance, but 2 million people is not 50 million people. So I have to keep talking about this until I feel like 50 million people at least have gotten the message so that I can counterbalance the impact of this one book.
Thank you so much for saying that. Yeah, didn't work for me either. And what didn't work for me was she was drunk when she was signing the contract. She said she didn't want to. I mean, we go, how is it that we're still having this conversation about consent? Here we are, 2018, and we're still having this conversation.
Consent feels complicated to some people. I mean, do you know the tea video, the tea analogy? Consent is like tea. If somebody says yes to tea and then changes their mind, don't make them drink tea. If they say yes and they pass out in the time it takes you to make the tea, obviously you don't pour tea down their throat. Just because they made you drank tea with you last night doesn't mean they want to wake up with you pouring tea down their throat in the morning. Mm-hmm. Just because they had tea with you one time doesn't mean they want to have tea with you every day. It's this really simple, beautiful analogy. I think it actually, like, tea is not as complicated a thing as sex, but I think about it as like, okay, so person A says, "Person B, would you like some tea?" And then this dual control model kind of thought process happens in person B's mind, where person B is like, what are the things I want and like right now? Like, I want to not hurt this person's feelings. I want to be friends with this person. I want to see this person's teacups. I want the milk and the cream. I want to tell my friends I had tea with this person. Like, there's all kinds of things person B could want. And then on the other side, things I don't want, things that hit the brakes, I don't want any tea right now. What does person B say in that context? And would that, if they say yes, does that count as consent? And what would it take? How do we create a world where person B can say, you know what I would really love is one of your teacups full of cream and sugar, or I'd be really glad to watch you drink some tea, but no tea for me, thanks.
Mm.
Like, that's the kind of sexual communication I want for everyone, that we can be clear about, like, there are some things I like and some things I don't like, or now that I've got this tea, I'm not feeling it. Do you want it here? You can take it back. It's not complicated, except that we get like our feelings get hurt and women in particular get taught to meet other people's expectations and not hurt people's feelings. In the second book, Burnout, Amelia and I, Amelia is my sister. I wrote it with my sister. We invented this phrase, human giver syndrome, which comes from this very dark but very short book that I highly recommend called Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny by a moral philosopher named Kate Mann. It is game changing. It made so many pieces click together for me when I read it. And one of the pieces was this thing, she posits a world, this is the cartoon version of it, where there's two types of humans. There are human beings who have a moral obligation to be their full humanity, to be acquisitive and competitive and entitled in order to take whatever it is they need in order to maximize their full human beingness, right? And then we've also got the human givers who have a moral obligation to give their full humanity in service of the human beings, to give their attention, their time, their love and affection, their bodies, their hopes and dreams, their very lives sacrificed on the altar of other people's comfort and happiness. And this is a moral obligation. If we fall short, hey, guess which one the women are? We're the givers. We have this obligation. And if we fall short of our obligation, then we can justly be punished. And the really hard part is that if no one punishes us, we'll just go right ahead and punish ourselves. We'll just beat the crap out of ourselves for falling short of this ideal. In the book, we categorize human givers as having an obligation to be pretty, happy, yet calm, generous, and attentive to the needs of others. And if in any way we fall short of that, we deserve to be punished. And when you take a human being and a human giver and put them in a sexual scenario, it leads to some really potentially destructive situations where the human giver feels morally obliged and the human being feels morally entitled to take whatever it is the human being wants for themselves, which leads us to situations. Another great book. I feel like I'm just like a book recommendation factory right now.
We love
it. Girls and Sex by Peggy Orenstein. So she interviewed all the teenage girls up into their 20s talking about their experiences of sexuality. And she tells the story of a high school aged girl who had a boy in her house and he wanted to have sex and he wouldn't leave. And so she gave him a blowjob so that he would leave her house, right? That's a human being and a human giver trying to work out a situation where she preserves her safety, de-escalates the situation, and gets what she needs by just sacrificing, okay, I guess I'll give you a blowjob. That's not the sex life I imagine for any young person, including for that guy. Like, he probably would rather have a sexual experience with someone who's like really into it, who like wants, please let me put your penis in my mouth. Yay! Like, that's the sex life I want for everybody. And if a person is falling short of that, like, there are times when it's just like, yeah, you want a blowjob? I'll give you a blowjob, sure thing. But this is coerced and, like, bribery. I'll leave your house if you do me this thing. So that's human giver syndrome, and it is a primary reason why consent is complicated. Because people trapped in these gender roles don't feel genuinely free to say yes or no.
My mind is, like, picturing even the last presidential race.
Yeah.
Human being and human doing. And
human giver. Yeah. Yeah. No, how dare a woman try to take from a man a position to which he is entitled by virtue of being a human being? Her job is to give, to be of service, not to be a leader, to compete for something where only one person can win. Mm-hmm. She should have the grace and dignity not to even run.
Right. And hysterical if she shows any kind of emotion. That
any kind of emotion. Yep. Oh, but if she doesn't show any emotion, then she's cold.
Yes. On one side, I think we're on the precipice of something either very, very good or very, very bad.
I have a similar feeling.
And I'm seeing more and more positive and more, there's more and more women like you out there talking about this, talking about shades of gray, talking about the body, talking about the brain, talking about sexuality. I think that maybe it might be my optimist, but I think that the louder that we get, the more and more we can either have it be, we can have it be something very good.
Yeah. I would love for it to go positively.
Yes.
And even if it doesn't go positively, if it goes, you know, I have an obvious opinion about what positively means for me, like pretty straightforward, that like, it's if a woman presidential candidate ever said, you know, I can grab men by the dick, they let you do it when you're famous. A woman couldn't do that, right?
Someday.
Yeah, true equality is when women are entitled to sexually abuse men as women, yeah, men are to, yeah, abuse
on a plane.
That's right. Not what we're looking for. That is not that is not the good. But even if things get worse, which they might, they could, even if they do, the more we work on building a foundation of a larger and larger group of people who believe in women's basic bodily autonomy, their right to control when and how they are touched, the more articulate we get about that, the more evidence-based we get about that, when we understand things like arousal non-concordance and responsive desire, which I know we're going to talk about, and the dual control model and the context sensitivity of pleasure, which I know we'll talk about, the more we can like talk about these things the way the science tells us is true, instead of just the way our deeply sex negative, shaming and misogynist culture teaches us, the more powerful we'll be to stand strong as a resistance if things do go downhill.
Yes.
So the work is important no matter what the short-term outcome is, because I am not an optimist. Mm. And yet I can't see a long-term human future that doesn't ultimately lead to women's basic bodily autonomy, access to educational and economic opportunities, and full freedom to say yes or no to the ways we're touched. Like, humanity doesn't exist in the far future without that.
Yes, and tampons in prisons in Texas.
Right? These are like the basic things. Just menstrual products to women living in prisons, living in domestic violence shelters, living in homeless shelters, like just working at the White House.
Yes.
Because this is our body and this is a thing it does.
What is exciting about this to me is that you are giving permission to women who are having this conversation. You are giving permission for women to know that they are normal. Mm-hmm. And the more women that we have knowing that they're normal, that we stop shaming ourselves, that we stop shaming each other, mm-hmm, and have these conversations and have these conversations about our bodies.
Yes.
Are turned on, that which means the more women are writing checks, and the more women that are writing checks, the more change, yes, we have. And my nieces are not going to have to in 40 years be having the same conversation.
Yeah. I know that the change is happening. I was just talking to someone who was sexually harassed in her workplace in the same week that her niece's first grade teacher touched her inappropriately. The little girl reported it and he got fired.
Yes.
So it wasn't as good for the woman in her workplace. Like, it was a much slower, agonizing, toxic experience. But like in that place, look, so there's movement. I know for sure that there's movement and that gives me hope.
Yes. So will you come back?
I have to, because we have to talk about responsive desire.
So much else to talk about. Oh my gosh. Okay. So tell us about how to find you and what you have going on right now.
Oh my gosh. So the easy place to find out what's going on is emilynagoski.com. I have a calendar and a map of the places that I'm going. If it's public, then I put it on the map. I'm about to do another little baby TED talk, a little TEDx talk. Then I'm going to Russia, and then I'm going to Toronto for Canadian Women in Medicine Conference, and I'm going to be at ASECT, and then I'm going back to Toronto for the Guelph Sexuality Conference. And then there's the Sexuality Conference in Chicago in July. So I'm like going all over the place. Yeah, it's really exciting. Oh, one of the coolest, most fun things is that in June, a Come As You Are workbook is being published. So it's based on the science, but it's just like packed with worksheets. Like, how are we going to make this work for you in your life? Including those, like, let's think through three great sexual experiences and three kind of meh sexual experiences. Thinking through strategies for, okay, so you want sex. How do we get you actually wanting sex? What's the process you go through to get your body into like a fun, excited, playful state? I'm so excited about it. I can't wait.
Oh, this is so good. Because the more women comfortable with themselves, the more women relating to themselves, like there is nothing wrong. The more women are feeling that fire and are able to Ignite the fire. And we all know the more oxytocin we are bathing ourselves in, the better this world is.
Loving and connected. Yep.
Yes. Thank you so much. And we'll schedule again soon. I can't wait.
Yes. Thank you.
Yay! Thank you so much for listening. If you are new to Ignite the Fire, thank you for being here. Please like and share and subscribe and review the podcast. If you are returning, thank you. I so appreciate it. Dr. Nagoski has scheduled another call in August, so we have that to look forward to. If you want more information about her, you can go to emilynagoski.com. My website is meganmriley.com. My social Facebook is at megan.m.riley0. My Instagram is at megan.m.riley. And I have loads of information everywhere. I have a newsletter. I have free videos on Facebook. Like, share, subscribe to this podcast. And any more information, please do send me an email, mail@meganmriley.com. Thank you so much.